I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro, back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-a, I go my way, back in the saddle again. I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44. Where you sleep out every night, and the only law is right.
Now, that was a song I was supposed to have played yesterday, which I completely left out. Poor old Gene Autry, that Jewish cowboy. Yeah, he couldn't even hardly sit on a horse. Oh, yeah. Mr. Lashon Rue, come over here and beat the shit out of Gene Autry. Oh, he's a faggot. Pardon me, faggots. You know something that chaps my hide? Well, really chaps my hide. Morris D. says I'm the most dangerous man in the country. Can you believe that? That is absolutely stupid. But if I'm the most mean guy, mean hombre in the country, and a bloodthirsty bastard probably got 35 Negroes buried in my backyard, if that's all true, how come I gotta go out and clean up the dog poop in my front yard? Answer me that. Well, now I went to automatic gain control, and I can see reduction in the audio, so maybe this is gonna work out pretty good. God damn, this is good. Dude, this is like, I'm telling you, man. Well, girls and boys, let's go back to state secrets. As I explained to you before, as I was reading this to you, this magazine was printed by the World Anti-Communist Organization out of Guadalajara, Mexico. That may sound strange to you, but that's where they were headquarters, and they did a damn good job, especially belling the cat, or belling the Jew. And along came a guy that you may have heard of if you've been around a while, General Singlob, who had been a commander in Korea in peacetime. General Singlob came in, created such a commotion as to kick out all the people that criticized the Jews. I'm not sure whether Singlob was a Jew or not, but he sure as hell could have been. And so they wiped out the World Anti-Communist Organization, which put out tremendous propaganda. And State Secrets was a series of magazines they put out. Anyhow, I'm going to go back to it now. obviously, Eisenhower was to write in his memoirs, the Germans sought to gain time in order to bring back into behind their, our lines the maximum number of men who were still fighting in the East. Pardon me, I've got some competition. This is why you have to have a bunker with a cement roof. Not a wood roof, I'll tell you. All the sounds come through. Anyhow, I began to have had enough. I ordered Bedell Smith to tell Yodel that if he did not immediately stop dragging out the negotiations, we would go so far as to use force in order to prevent the refugees from crossing to the west. This, in fact, is just what the Americans did. Thus, by his obstinate intransigence, Eisenhower handed over hundreds of thousands and perhaps even millions of innocent Germans to the appalling Bolshevik tyranny, which for the majority meant either death or concentration camps, and for the women the prospect of certain rape and violation. Was he ignorant or unaware of the lot that awaited them? Did he deliberately condemn these unhappy people to the terrible fate in order to carry out the dire Yalta Agreement? That is a question which I cannot answer, but this inhuman order will leave an indelible blot on Eisenhower's memory. Between 5th of May and the date of the armistice concluded with the British, the 9th of May, the date of the general capitulation, Admiral Dönitz, by means of all resources at his disposal, succeeded in rescuing 3 million German soldiers and civilians who thus escaped the Russian slavery owing to the understanding of Field Marshal Montgomery. Postscript. On the 12th of January 1971, Le Monde, a newspaper, French newspaper, published a news report concerning the war in Indochina, from which we had taken the following extracts. Quote, the trial of Lieutenant William Calley, the leading defendant accused of the Song Mai massacre on 16 March 1968, when several hundred Vietnamese villagers were killed by American troops, reopened yesterday before the court-martial at Fort Benning, Georgia. In his memoirs, which he has just published, Lieutenant Calley has implicated the whole American Army in Vietnam. For his part, the former public prosecutor of the United States at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials, Mr. Telford Taylor, considers the former commander-in-chief of the American forces, General Westmoreland, was just as responsible during the Second World War as his Japanese counterpart was held to be. If the criteria which were applied against General Yamashita, who was found guilty of atrocities committed by his troops in the Philippines during the Second World War, were likewise applied to the Army personnel such as General Westmoreland, Mr. Taylor declared he could find himself in the same situation. A general should control the conduct of his troops, and he should be held responsible for it. Today, professor of law at the University of Columbia, Mr. Taylor is not generally known as a radical, but he considers that the trial of court-martial of a lieutenant, a captain, and a sergeant for the massacre of the villagers at Song Mai is a waste of time, since it's not at this level that the really guilty parties will be found. Besides, he added, much more serious than Song Mai was the question of the deaths of all the civilians caused by the bombing raids, and fact that the peasants were being forced to evacuate their villages. He claims that a presidential commission should be set up to investigate war crimes, but never was. For his part, Lieutenant Calley has stated, both in the declaration in Associated Press and in the memoirs which he has just published, that his trial completely ignored the realities of the war and of what actually happened at Song Mai. We went to Vietnam to save those people, but we didn't even give them the crumbs off our own table. We hadn't even got the courtesy to learn their language or their customs. We despised them and we killed them. The trial of another member of the company opened before a court-martial at Fort McPherson. A 22-year-old sergeant was accused of having killed a half a dozen Vietnamese civilians. The young sergeant had admitted in a statement to the inquiry board on the 17th of November 1969 that he had taken part in the massacre, and his statement was read out in front of the court-martial. Quote, "The soldiers entering the village on 16th of March, and it was a massacre," said Sergeant Hudhu. "We shot into the houses, at the people, whether stationary or running. I did not agree with these murders, but those were our orders." "Can you explain why all the villagers were killed?" the prosecutor asked. "They were all regarded as communists," according to Captain Medina. It's interesting that, this magazine is old and falling apart, and I had it held together with rubber bands. It seems like we end at 72 or 73, and it goes to 70. No, wait a minute. Here's 73. Then it jumps to 76, unless these pages... Oh, hell, the pages are stuck together. Duh! Okay. Considers the former commander-in-chief of American forces, General Westmoreland, was just as responsible for the Second World War as his Chinese or Japanese counterparts was held to be. If the criteria which were applied against... Now, I've read that. Sorry, boys and girls. Yeah. Okay, now we go to the correct page. Now we're going to chapter 5. In other words, you got the message. Our forces operated just as brutally and viciously as any other forces, maybe more so. And you got the message about us pattern bombing as a act of war against the populations of Europe, not only Germany, but wherever the Germans might have been in Europe. I mean, they bombed the shit out of the French, too, because Germans were there. So you begin to see where this American military-industrial complex military is not the goody-two-shoes they've told you all your life. And, of course, a hell of a lot of guys who were over there in World War II, World War I, and Vietnam, they know this. But... for reasons of their family and so forth, they don't talk about it. Or a lot of them commit suicide or drink themselves to death or take drugs till they die. The mysterious Tehran and Yalta agreements and the secret Zabrowski document. Now, you're not going to get this stuff many other places because it just isn't around. Because it indicts Jewish criminals, plus red, white, and blue people like Eisenhower as goddamn war criminals. In 1949, the Spanish ambassador to Chile, Señor D.M. Dosyenigui, published a book entitled Hispana Tenía Razón, Spain Was Right. All the quotations up to page 86 in this chapter were taken from the book, in which he reveals Spain's attitude towards Soviet communism, the Axis powers, and the Allies during the course of the Second World War. At that time, he was principal private secretary to Count Giordano, who was then Spain's foreign minister. Thus, he was directly involved in the events which he described in his book at first hand, and he reveals to us a secret document of the utmost importance concerning the Yalta agreements. On 16th of April 1943, a sumptuous ceremony was held at the Barcelona in the Palace of the Kings in of Aragon in honor of the 450th anniversary of Christopher Columbus' return from his first voyage, when he had been presented to Ferdinand and Isabella and announced the discovery of the New World. It was attended by many eminent Spanish and South American personalities. After a solemn Te Deum had been sung in the Cathedral of Barcelona, various speeches were delivered in the royal palace, including one by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Count Jordana. Minutely prepared and thought out, his remarks were addressed to the whole world and should have had considerable repercussions. He announced that Spain was taking a new step towards forward in pursuance of Plan D, which had been drawn up in order to facilitate peace negotiations. After asserting Spain's total independence from any foreign influence, he recalled that Spanish policy in the present, as in the past, was based upon Christian principles and traditions, and that in consequence his country could not be identified with those whose regimes were opposed to this ideology, which clearly meant that Spain, her government, could not be identified with a political system such as National Socialism. Set apart from the world conflict, Spain's high mission at the opportune moment was to facilitate the reestablishment of a just and fraternal peace, but also to draw the attention to all peoples to the profound spiritual subversion and economic upheavals which would result from the war. More terrible and more destructive than the war, said Count Jordana. More charged with hatred and wicked passions is the communist revolution, which represented all the greater danger, since the enormous cost of the war would compromise the social stability of nations. Right on there, boy. Some hours after Count Jordana's speech, Mr. Cordell Hull, American Secretary of State. Remember, Cordell Hull was the one who allegedly committed suicide at Bethesda Naval Hospital sometime after this. They said he dove out a, you know, five-story window. Smart Money says he was pushed. He was assassinated. The whole world knows that the sole objective of the United Nations is nothing less than unconditional surrender of Germany. At that moment, Mr. Cordell Hull had only read several telegraphic references to Count Jordana's speech, and not the complete text. He told the press that he knew nothing about Spain's proposition to negotiate world peace at the earliest possible opportunity. For their part, Berlin and Rome ignored the proposition and reaffirmed their determination unhesitatingly to pursue the common struggle until the peril which threatened Europe in both East and West had been overcome. However, Count Jordana's speech was all the more important since the Spanish government had just been made aware of the existence of the document, which was so important that it threatened the security of the great number of European countries. The document in question was a secret letter which had been written by President Roosevelt on 20th February 1943 to Jew Zabruski, who was at the time acting as a liaison officer between himself and Stalin. Here is the full text of the letter, heading the White House, 20 February 1943. Dear Mr. Zabrowski, as I have already had the pleasure of telling you, together with Mr. Weiss, I am deeply moved to hear that the National Council of Young Israel has been so extremely kind as to propose me as mediator with our common friend Stalin in these difficult moments. Hold it. When any menace of friction among the United Nations, in spite of the many self-denying declarations which have been obtained, would have fatal consequences for all, but principally for the USSR itself. It is therefore in your interest and ours, quiet. It is therefore in your interest and ours to round off the corners which becomes difficult to bring about with Litvinov, to whom I have had very regretfully to point out that those who sought a quarrel with Uncle Sam would get something to complain about with regard to internal as well as external affairs, for having regard to communist activities in the States of the American Union, his claims are absolutely intolerable. Timoshenko proved more reasonable in his brief but fruitful visit, and indicated that the new interview with Marshal Stalin might constitute a rapid means of arriving at a direct exchange of views. I reckon that this is more and more urgent, particularly when one remembers all the good which has resulted from Churchill's talk with Stalin. The United States and Great Britain are ready, without any reservations, to give the USSR absolute parity and voting rights in the future reorganization of the post-war world. She will therefore take part, as the English Prime Minister let me know when sending him the first draft from Aden, in the directing group in the heart of the councils of Europe and in Asia. She has a right to do this, not only through her vast intercontinental situation, but above all because of her magnificent struggle against Nazism, which will win the praise of history and civilization. It is our intention to speak on behalf of our great country and the mighty British Empire that these continental consuls be constituted by the whole of the independent states in each case, with equitable proportional representation. And you can, my dear Zabrowski, assure Stalin that the USSR will find herself on a footing of complete equality, having an equal voice with the United States and England in that direction of the said consuls of Europe and Asia. Equally with Britain, or England and the United States, she will be a member of the High Tribunal, which will be created to resolve differences between the nations. And she will take part similarly and identically to the selection, preparation, armament, and command of the international forces, which, under the orders of the Continental Council, will keep watch within each state to see that peace is maintained in the spirit worthy of the League of Nations. Very interesting. Thus, these interstate entities and their associated armies will be able to impose their decisions and to make themselves obeyed. This is written by Roosevelt, remember. This being the case, a position so elevated in the tetrarchy of the universe ought to give Stalin enough satisfaction not to renew claims which are capable of creating insoluble problems for us. In this way, the American continent will remain outside all Soviet influence and within the exclusive concern of the United States, as we have promised the countries of our continent it shall. Well, of course, they had spies all over the country. Spies in the White House. In Europe, France will gravitate into the British orbit. We have reserved for France a secretariat with a consultative voice, but without voting rights, as a reward for her present resistance and as a penalty for her former weakness. Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Greece will develop under the protection of England towards a modern civilization which will lift them out of their historical decline. We will grant the USSR an access to the Mediterranean. We'll accede to her wishes concerning Finland and the Baltic, and we shall require Poland to show a judicious attitude of comprehension and compromise. Stalin will still have a wide field for expansion in the little unenlightened countries of Eastern Europe. In other words, fuck it, take them over. Enslave the people. Always taking into account the rights which are due to the fidelity of Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, he will completely recover the territories which have temporarily been snatched from Great Russia and give it back to Russia. Most important of all, after the partition of the Third Reich and the incorporation of its fragments with other territories to form new nationalities which will have no link with the past, the German threat will be conclusively disappear insofar as being any danger to the USSR, to Europe, and to the entire world. Now remember, this is the President of the United States sending this to a Jew. Turkey, but it will serve no useful purpose to discuss that question further. It needs full understanding, and Churchill has given the necessary assurances to President Inanu in the name of us both. The access to the Mediterranean contrived for Stalin ought to content him. Asia, we are in agreement with his demands, except for any complications which might arise later. As for Africa, again, what need for discussion? We must give something back to France and even compensate her for her losses in Asia. It will also be necessary to give Egypt something. Now, you take notice, they're not asking the people of Africa or North Africa what they want. They're just taking it. As has already been promised to the Wafdist government, as regards Spain and Portugal, they will have to be recompensated for the renunciations necessary to achieve better universal balance. That's double talk if I ever heard it. The United States will also share in the distribution by right of conquest, and they will be obliged to claim some points which are vital for their zone of influence. This right of conquest is only fair. Conquest. I thought that's what you didn't like the Germans for. Right of conquest. Brazil, too, must be given a small colonial expansion which had been offered to her. Why not? Give her half of another country. In view of the rapid annihilation of the Reich, convince Stalin, my dear Mr. Zabrutsky, Jew, that he ought to give way for the good of all in the matter of the colonies in Africa, and to abandon all propaganda and intervention in the industrial centers of America. How naive can you be, Roosevelt? Assure him also that my complete understanding and my entire sympathy and desire to facilitate these solutions, in other words, I'll kiss your ass, which makes more timely than ever the personal discussion which I propose. The above is only a general outline of a plan which is intended for further study. The only reason I give Roosevelt any out at all was he was sick and dying when he was writing this shit. As I told you at the time, I was very pleased with the gracious terms of the letter informing me of your decision and of the desire you expressed to offer me, in the name of National Council, a copy of the greatest treasure of Israel, the scroll of the Torah. This letter will convey the confirmation of my acceptance to those who are so frank with me. I respond with the greatest confidence. Be so good, I beg you, to transmit my gratitude to the distinguished body over which you preside, recalling the happy occasion at the banquet on its 31st anniversary. I wish you every success in your work as an interpreter. Very sincerely yours, Franklin Roosevelt. Oh, we never kissed the ass of the Jews. We never got our tongue out of their ass. The version of the letter has been translated from French, which in turn was taken from the original Spanish, as published on pages 198 to 199 of Señor Dasagüe's book, España Tiene Razón. The author commented upon it as follows, quote, "So, by the benevolent resolve of Mr. Roosevelt, who was then preparing for the Tehran Conference, in full agreement with Stalin, Central Europe, with the exception of Turkey and Greece, through the latter was to be deprived of Thrace in order to give the USSR free access to the Mediterranean. The Baltic countries and certain countries of the Western Empire, such as Holland, Belgium, and Switzerland, were to come under the Soviet domination. Germany was to be dismembered, while the Asiatic continent, including the French colonies, would also enter the Soviet sphere. In Africa, certain promises were made to Stalin. As the counterpart to this, in Western Europe, Italy, France, Spain, and Portugal were to pass under the protection of England. America would remain entirely outside the influence and propaganda of the Soviets." Well, talk about that's a bullshit. "But what is more, the USSR would take a hand in the choice and preparation of international forces which were to be active within all European states, including those of the West, and the Asian states constituted as the Council of Asia and European states constituted as the Council of Europe were to be directed by a group comprising the United States, the USSR, England, and China on a footing of complete equality, in complete disregard to the right of to independence possessed by each of the countries so disposed of, and also all that was representative of Christian civilization in continent of Europe." they drag out religion. Yeah. Well, they said complete equality and said complete disregard to the right of independence possessed by each of the countries so disposed of. So he gave away the independence of the United States, Roosevelt. Spain, together with all the other European countries, would be subject to this directory body in which her worst enemy would be a member, the same enemy that had led the fight against us throughout the Civil War, and which could never forgive Spain for the defeat that it had inflicted on it under the guidance of Franco. A mere glance at this letter is enough to explain the amazement and agitation and fear we felt when we became aware of it. Our ardent desire to see peace come with all speed before President Roosevelt's plans could be realized can easily be imagined. Knowledge of this letter was the key to all the actions and gestures of Spain and served as a basis for the political discussions of its rulers. Thanks to this letter, we knew that Dasyange's book had to expect the post-war period. An immense catastrophe threatened to descend on Europe and all of its old civilization, which was the Cold War, which Roosevelt helped bring on. In fact, he instigated it. 1 month later, on 9th May 1943, General Franco made an important speech in Almeria, of which we have extracted the principal passages. Quote, "After he had renewed Spain's appeal for peace, since he considered it was madness to continue a war behind which there loomed up the specter of something infinitely worse, General Franco explained how communism, the sore of hatred and barbarism, represented the image of anti-Europe, the negation of our civilization and the destruction of everything which we hold most dear and valuable. In making this speech, General Franco had in mind Roosevelt's letter to Zabruski, the Jew, and he hoped that the solution would be found to end the conflict before the incredible concessions which the letter promised to Russia were carried out. One of the principal obstacles which would confront Spanish plan for peace was the existence of a real incompatibility between National Socialist ideals and those of the rest of the civilized world. If the Spanish proposition was to have a chance of succeeding, it would be necessary to diminish the gap between these principles, which were not only political, but even more so religious nature. 2 days after this speech, the United States Ambassador Carlton Hayes sent a letter, secret letter, to the State Department in Washington. The State Department's always been a, as far as I'm concerned, a enemy of the United States, whose contents became known to the Spanish government, in which he requested that the Barcelona-Almira statements should not be interpreted in the United States as being inspired by the Axis. Spain, he wrote, seeks above all to preserve the independent policy which is not subject to any foreign power. She wishes to avoid any compromise, and she has decided to fight any aggressor from whatever side of an attack might be mounted against her, either by the Axis or the Allies. Nevertheless, it is true that she is in favor of victory going to the Allies. The Spanish Plan D for peace was met with skepticism on both sides of the struggle. A furious press campaign was let loose against Spain, especially after the Barcelona and Almira statements. In England, but above all in America, where the war was not popular, and the government had been compelled to conduct an active propaganda campaign to convince the people of the necessity for war. Roosevelt, who had a strong impression of Spain, had drawn up a plan for the invasion of Spain at the same time that the American troops were disembarking in Africa. He also set off a slanderous press and radio campaign in order to prepare public opinion for this eventuality. However, the conciliatory attitude of the Spanish government and the assurance that no measure would be taken prejudicial to the Allies in their future military operations in the Mediterranean were recognized by the United States Ambassador in Madrid, who wrote to the State Department on the 22nd of June 1943 to this effect. Quote, towards the end of 1942 and in the early part of 43, the Allies brought increased pressure to bear on Spain to improve their relations with the Soviet Union. At that time, Russia had begun to take initiative in the attack and began a series of victories which were to lead her from the Volga to Berlin. She was held in considerable prestige by the Allies, who were then of the opinion that communism was less dangerous to the economic life of a country than National Socialism. That's bullshit. But for Spain, on the contrary, Russia was still the real common enemy of England and the United States, as well as of Germany and Italy. This opinion was strongly contested by America, who invited Spain to collaborate with Russia unless she wished to lose her economic aid from the United States. Yeah, you got to go deal with those communists. Yeah, because I'm telling you to, because I'm a goddamn communist. Spanish ambassadors had an exchange of views on this subject with the governments of Germany and Italy, as well as with the Vatican. On the 18th of March, 1943, His Holiness Pope Pius XII received our ambassador, M. Barcinas, in audience. He congratulated him on the agreement which existed between Spanish government and the Vatican, and approved our attitude with regard to the menace of National Socialism. On the latter subject, he had some very hard words to say. He was under no illusion that in time there would come a lessening of the anti-religious policy of the Reich. It was during this period of tension that on 21st October 1943, Mr. Hayes, the United States ambassador at Madrid, sent Count Giordana a letter in which he spoke in the name of his government. He blamed Spain for confusing communism with Russia and requesting him to cease making official attacks against the latter country, which was an important member of the United Nations and an ally of the United States. An American ambassador accused the Spanish government of complacency towards Nazi Germany and being thus the only free country to favor the latter. Communism, he wrote, was essentially an interior problem of Russia and in no way affected any country whose standard of living was sufficiently high to render its development impossible. How do you like that? Communism was no real threat as long as you were rich. Okay, of course, most of the world wasn't rich. Okay, for not only had they no intention whatever of opposing communism at the end of the war, they were not going to permit Russia to collaborate closely with the United Nations in future international peace conferences. That's Spanish. Briefly, the United States were displeased by Spain's attitude to Russia and felt that it constituted a powerful obstacle preventing the amelioration of their mutual relations. Finally, the American ambassador left Count Giordana with a note resuming the tenor of his communication. When he had departed, Count Giordana read the note with care and wrote at the head of the first page, quote, "This note is of uttermost gravity since it is not written in his own name, but in the name of his government." A few days later, after Count Giordana replied to the American ambassador, distinguished between the American point of view, which had influenced by psychology of the war, and by the powerful aid which Russia contributed towards a common victory, Count Giordana showed that the real problem lay on a spiritual level which far surpassed the actual development of events. The war was in fact a passing phenomenon and only secondary to the heart of the problem which lay in communism. Spain, from its privileged situation as a neutral country, was in a position to study the grave problems of the day with greater serenity and objectivity. And because her policy was founded on Christian principles, she considered that the most fundamental problem of the age lay in the Bolshevik revolutionary movement of the masses who had been robbed of their faith and which tended to seize countries by means of disorder and violence. Here are the principal passages from Count Giordana's letter. As General Franco has on many an occasion stated, and in particular his speech of 1st October, Spain considers that independently of the outcome of the war and behind it, the world is faced with a spiritual problem of the utmost importance created by revolutionary conditions of the masses who have been separated from all belief in God and whose aim is to improve their economic situation by recourse to violence and the utterly unscrupulous use of means whatever. Well, I would have some sympathy with this guy, but what about the enslaving by the church? Hundreds of years have gone by enslaving and murdering people in the name of the church. So when you're going to start talking about this kind of stuff, you've got to spread it around. This revolutionary spirit, which is comprised of varying hues, is known by the generic name of Bolshevism. The war is only a passing phenomenon as long as this spirit, which is much deeper and more lasting than the war itself, exists. I am sure Your Excellency will understand my astonishment and apprehension at learning that it is your conviction that the revolutionary peril can be overcome simply by raising the standard of living of the needy classes, as if there were not millions of Communist Party members in the most economically advanced countries. I can hardly believe that someone could imagine that gigantic peril which threatens our civilization can be resolved by mere adjustments of salaries. No, Your Excellency, it is not the widest, in the widest sense of the word. We are confronted with a spiritual problem, the evil of the utmost gravity, which reaches down to the deepest level, the human soul. Well, my position on this is Catholic Church and all the rest of the churches got to clean their own doorstep, because they've been up to their ears in the worst forms of inhumanity themselves. And just to say, well, the Bolsheviks opposed Christianity is not enough to totally relegate them to the trash dump as far as that belief, because there's a lot of other beliefs that believe pretty much the same thing. So this is a problem. This group down in Guadalajara was very Catholic oriented, so you hear a lot of this. We are confronted with a spiritual problem, an evil and utmost gravity which reaches down to the deepest levels in the human soul. For when you teach the masses that morality is only bourgeoisie prejudice, and that there is no superior justice to which we are responsible for our acts, you remove the brake and urge them to attack any obstacle which opposes the satisfaction of their most brutal instincts. I think that's an overcompensation. Does not necessarily have to be that way. Even Lenin said what we need to do is not shut down the churches, but not finance them. And that's the problem in this country. You don't need to shut down the churches. People are free to give their own money and build churches and worship the way they want. But when you give them tax exemption, you're building a monster. And we've got a monster here, and it could end up in mass killings by evangelicals. Don't laugh. I've had enough contact with them to know that they could do that. I remember going to a quasi-religious meeting. It was supposed to be political, in a town about 20 miles from me. I told you people this a couple of years, maybe 3-4 years ago. And I went because they advertised they were showing a movie about the Palestinians in the Middle East. So I went there, and I was very upset because the movie made it all the problem of the Palestinians. The Jews were wonderful, no problem. It was just those Palestinians and so forth. And at the end of the film, they asked if anybody had anything to questions, and I stood up and I said, look, I think that film is a little sidetracking. I think it's too pro-Israel, because there's a lot of other things that need to be talked about here. And the whole room of all these evangelical Christians went crazy. They got really nasty. And one guy jumped up over the back of the chair behind me and said, if anybody touches the Jews, I ran a machine gun in Korea and I would use it against anybody that's against the Jews. I said, aren't you an American? Don't you have respect for America? He said, no, Jews. If anybody touches them, I'll kill them. And boy, he was looking at me real hard. So I slowly got up and left. So that's the fanaticism of many, a large percentage of these people. And you better watch them. they can come to your door, front door, and be as nice and gentlemanly and lovingly as possible. They do that to me all the time. But if you start disagreeing with them and telling them they're wrong, the attitude changes real fast. They don't necessarily get violent, but you can begin to see in their eyes that they're really upset. Now, if those people were really totally running the country, and this Middle Eastern thing heated up really, really bad against the Jews, and you oppose helping the Jews, or you were more for being equal in your application of sympathy in the Middle East, and you were vocal about it in a church or in a meeting, watch it. They could become killers like you wouldn't believe. Now, of course, most people won't believe me when I say that, but I'm telling you, these fanatic Christians have to be watched. And they're armed to the teeth, too. A lot of you people think they're really on your side, and some of them are. But more of them are not than are. I can hardly believe that someone could imagine that the gigantic peril which threatens our civilization can be resolved by mere adjustment of salaries. No, Your Excellency, it's not only an economic question, nor even a social problem, in the widest sense of the word. We are confronted with a spiritual problem and evil of the utmost gravity, which reaches down to the deepest levels of the human soul. Prove to me you got a soul, buddy. For when you teach the masses that morality is only a bourgeois prejudice, and that there are no superior justice to which we are responsible for in our acts, you remove the brake and urge them to attack any obstacle which opposes the satisfaction of their most brutal instincts. That same thing can be true of the Christians too. But we do it differently. We give our tax money to the military-industrial complex to help the Israelis have 200 atomic bombs, give them all the tanks they want, give them all the weapons they need, the latest weapons, the latest aircraft. They can't even turn a fighter around over Israel without going up across the border. They have to fly out over the Mediterranean. That's how small Israel is. One cannot state that Bolshevism is simply an internal problem of the Russians. The Spanish government is in possession of documents and proofs which demonstrate that the Spanish communist movement was organized by agents who came from Moscow. Of course they did. And nobody can be ignorant of the fact that the revolutionary spirit which bubbled up from the underground throughout the whole world is internally upheld and supported by the government of the Soviet Union. Its slogan, "Proletarians of the World Unite," is the flag of rebellion against our present society and an appeal to its destruction. Well, there are parts of it that need destruction, but not all of it. The Soviet Union advocates the dictatorship of the proletariat, a regime which is to be imposed by force. While Spain has no quarrel with the Russian nation as such, she is extremely uneasy at the contemplating the self-proclaimed mission of the Soviet Union to foment revolution throughout the entire world, and at the hands of which she has suffered so much in recent years herself, with the blood of thousands of deaths and enormous destruction of property caused by communist activity in her own country. When one considers the real image of the Soviet Union and its doctrine and somber designs, it was not without apprehension that Spain witnessed the military victories of the Soviets, behind which were reared up the spectacle of a terrifying future, notably for those European countries occupied by the Soviet armies. And that's why so many people stuck with Germany or the National Socialists, because they didn't have any other choice. They knew that if they didn't, they were going to get crushed by the communist Russians. I mean, you know, so that's why so many smaller countries in Europe stuck with National Socialism, even though they might not have liked National Socialism, but it was better than communism. This is why Spain could not share the optimism of the United States ambassador, neither as far as concerned the so-called religious liberty said to exist in the Soviet Union at the present time, and which the final analysis would appear to be purely political expediency, nor as far as concerned a supposed evolution of the Soviet system. Spain can state with full realization of the truth of the assertion that any democratic regime which in any way resembled the Soviet system would be abused by Russian agents who benefited from the liberty conferred on them by the former, would use it to work for their own ends and for the eventual substitution of our regime. This is precisely what happened at Madrid during the Civil War when Largo Cabrillo, the Spanish Lenin and the head of the Red Government, was overthrown by a Republican Democratic faction which sprang from the Communist bloc. Although the Republicans themselves have tolerated Communist atrocities without protest, they were nevertheless driven out of their turn by the Soviet Russian agents, and their henchmen were stirred up a veritable revolution with violent strife in March 1939. Señor Dasingo, in his book, continues, quote, the Spanish foreign minister had received a very clear impression that the exchange which had been begun by the Ambassador Hayes had expressed the point of view that the State Department and his reply of 29 October, which set out with this great sincerity and solid argument that the doctrinal basis of Spanish thinking and policy towards the war was most important statement of its kind yet to have been published. Ambassador Hayes replied to the Spanish foreign minister, dated 27 December 43, took some little notice of the arguments presented by Count Giordano, but nevertheless considered that Russia was a victim of German aggression. We have extracted the principal points of this matter below. The ambassador agreed that communist Marxism was a real danger to the free world, but at the same time he thought that Spain, under the influence of the recent civil war, had an exaggerated fear of Russia and an immoderate confidence in Nazi Germany. He could not believe that the Russian communism, despite the regime of terror which it had been inaugurated, and its subversive influence in Spain before and during the civil war, constitute a greater danger than the German Nazism, which he held represented a much greater threat to the liberty of nations and to the traditional Christian civilization. It was Germany which had attacked Russia and Europe in order to devastate them. Well, that was the biggest mistake that they ever made in history. The American ambassador forgot that in 1939, by agreement with Germany, Soviet Russia had invaded Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, and all those inhabitants had been deported and had been brutally attacked in Finland. After the war, he thought, the Russian menace to Europe and the world would in no way compare to the threat posed by the alliance between Nazi Germany and pagan Japan. Pagan Japan. I salute pagan Japan, man. Besides, for a long time, Russia would be dependent on her allies for aid to enable her to repair her own ravages, and for that reason alone would be obliged to observe the Atlantic Charter. The rebirth of religious feeling and patriotism was a guarantee of her goodwill and desire for international collaboration. Therefore, Spain could no longer continue in the role of peacemaker if she still persisted in an intransigent attitude to Russia. Well, that was good of Spain. On the 11th January 1944, Count Jordana replied to Hayes and told him that the struggle in which Spain was engaged against communism was far superior in concept to that being waged by the Axis. It was already necessary to distinguish between the errors of Hitler's regime, which were repugnant to the Catholic conscience, and the Spanish nation, and Germany's geographical situation in the front line of the defense of Europe against the appalling storm arising in the steppes of Asia. A call for the rectification of the equivocal doctrines of Nazism was no reason for destroying the defensive strength of Germany, considered as a front line of the resistance against the deadly invasion from Asia. And for that reason, it was essential to save Germany from the risk of annihilation. To put it briefly, if Nazism was a decidedly abominable idea for a diplomat, Germany represented in Europe's European reality, which had to be taken into consideration. And that's it for today, boys and girls. But just to ask yourself this, who let the cat out of the bag? Let the commie out of the bag. Let the Bolshevik out of the bag. Things were pretty squared away until Hitler opened up on Barbarossa. Now, I know it's weird to ask, but even Hitler, and he was a pretty smart guy, but the question would be, was he so screwed up that he thought that he surely could win against the Soviet Union? I guess so, but did he sit down and think about what the ramifications are if he didn't win against the Soviet Union? And all these people in all these other countries would be tromped on and killed and put in a gulag and everything else. So whether you like to say it or think it or not, it's Hitler that opened the door to Bolshevism to a crass invasion of Europe. Because if there hadn't have been Operation Barbarossa, I think that Europe would have been left in good shape. So anyhow, sometimes unintended circumstances, or intended circumstances sometimes, can really bite you in the ass. That's why I'm critical and suspicious of the right wing, because a lot of things they do actually foments more problems than they solve. In fact, in most cases. So that after you've been involved for years and decades, you begin to wonder, who in hell's really behind the right wing?
The real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog.
Name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, come follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and Tom's ever faithful companion.